I call a meeting of the March 19th, 2025 meeting of the House Public Safety Committee to order. Appears that a quorum is present. Before we begin the meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee expects property quorum at all times. All dialogue goes through the chair. Signs are not allowed in the committee room. There will be no outbursts or clapping. There's no standing, sitting, or excuse me, there's no standing or sitting in the walkways or alleys. If an accommodation is needed, communicate that with the sergeant staff. There will be consequences if there is a disruption. Thank you to the sergeant staff who are present for helping out maintain a decorum in the committee room. Representative Blitz, have you read the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have, and I moved them.
We noticed that there was one thing that needed to be moved that I noticed. In review of the March 18th minutes, it does not list Representative Tabke as being present, but then it lists Representative Tabke is making a motion, so I assume you were here yesterday.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
I would entertain a motion to reflect the fact that Representative Tabke was present at the March 12th meeting.
So moved, Mr. Chair. 18th.
Thank you. All in favor of the motion to approve the minutes as approved, signify by saying aye, as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All as opposed, say nay. Minutes passed. First bill on our agenda is House File 1800. The bill relates to elections and was re-referred to the Public Safety Committee from Elections and Finance Government Operations Committee because it includes a felony penalty. Representative Kwong, I see her at the testifier table. I will move House File 1800 before the committee. I understand you have an amendment coded A3. I will move your amendment before the committee. Please explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment is basically deleting things out that were brought up as concerns in the previous committee and to clean it up. And by doing so, we also no longer would need to go to the Judiciary Committee. And these were all things where one of the parties had some concerns. We said we would work with them, and thus we removed the the things they had concerns about. It's not adding any additional language that wasn't voted and passed through the previous committee.
All right. Does anyone have any questions on Representative Kwong's amendment? All in favor of approving the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Motion carries. Chair Kwong, please begin your testimony on the provisions of your bill that relate to the felony criminal penalties.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And basically, because of some of the high profile things that had to do with lost or destroyed or thrown away documents in the recent election, plus in past elections, like in 02, someone took ballots to their home and burned them in the fireplace and said, oh, they were spoiled ballots. And that was determined, that election was determined by like 6 votes, and 3 times as many ballots were destroyed. People know that you are to protect and keep election documents and articles. And so the idea is if it's listed as a felony, then people might take more notice and purposely try to avoid the accidental throwing away of ballots, envelopes, and other documents and, you know, things affiliated with elections. So that is the the whole intent is to prevent future controversial things in elections. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Quam. Questions for Chair Quam, members? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Quam, this actually may be for you, Mr. Chair. Can you just confirm the portions, and I'm sorry, I'm just catching up here, that are within our jurisdiction, that we are to focus on within our committee? And you may have said that, Chair, and I may have just missed it. My apologies.
Chair Quam.
If nonpartisan staff wanted to note, I believe there are three very small portions.
Point us to them if they can.
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I came from a previous committee and did not have time to return to my office.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, there is a misdemeanor penalty on page 8 at sit lines 27 and 28. There is a felony provision that is on page 14. That's at lines 10 and 11. Mr. Chair, I believe that was all of the new criminal penalties that were in this bill.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll assume those are sort of the areas to focus on. And I guess I would think, I believe that those are already crimes. I guess I'm looking especially at the one on page 8. And I believe 60948 is the statute that I think it's already a violation of. I'm just wondering sort of in what way does this differ from existing law, Chair Quam?
Chair Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And basically we're putting things in and referenced in the election area so that people are aware of, sometimes it's less obvious and connected, but the big thing on 14 is making it a felony to dispose of voted ballots before the end of the retention period. It was not previously a felony.
Representative Pinto, Mr. Johnson's phone, one more reference.
Yeah, let's bring in phone a friend. Sure, thanks.
Mr. Chair, members, my apologies. There is a third offense that is on page 19. And you can see that on line 11, page 19, line 11.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm looking. So the first one that was on page 8, and again, I'm kind of doing this on the fly here, but the willfully making a false statement, this would be a misdemeanor with a $10,000 fine, which is an unusual combination. But I think under 60948, that would be a felony, and I think this might actually be undermining your intent, Chair Quam. You'd be causing people to receive a lesser offense if your law passes than under current law, potentially for making a false statement on an affidavit of candidacy. So just that alone, I guess, makes me think that this is not fully baked. I guess it's being laid over, Mr. Chair. So yeah.
Chair Quam.
Yeah, but yeah, I'd love to hear what Chair Quam has to say about that.
Chair Quam.
If you'd allow a oral amendment to delete 28, 27, and 28, and that would remove the concerning issues. The intent of this bill is to be a non-controversial, technical corrections-type bill for elections, and the A3 was removing ones where members of different parties had concerns about that, and I am fine with taking Representative Pinto's judgment and removing those two lines that he has a concern about.
Representative Quam, given the potential impact on the fiscal note, and this is a pretty serious thing to be dealing with here, I would recommend that you work with Representative Pinto on doing this offline. We will be, as I said, laying this over. So. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so Representative Quam, so that was the first one, and I'm glad to know you'd be, so of the three in front of us, that's one that sounds like maybe going. Then the second one on page 14, destruction and disposal of voted ballots, I believe, and I was just looking under 204C.41, that kind of misconduct by those involved in elections is already a felony. And so what this would do is, I guess, duplicate that. I understand your concern about having folks be able to sort of look in a particular area of statute, but the problem is creating a whole new crime can have some pretty pernicious consequences. So I just have concerns. Maybe I'll just note it just as a comment. I understand you described it as a cleanup, but my understanding is that the bill is actually opposed not only by our Secretary of State, but also by Association of Minnesota Counties, League of Minnesota Cities, Minnesota Association of County Officers. So there's quite widespread opposition to this potential cleanup bill. And so I appreciate the changes both you made in the amendment and the change you're willing to make just now, but I guess it makes me think that overall it's not ready for moving forward, and I guess it's going to be laid over anyway, so we'll continue to look at it. Thank you, Chair.
Chair Quam, care to respond? Or Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually, as somebody who was on the Elections Committee, just going to say the same thing as Mr. Pinto, as Representative Pinto, so I will not I'll repeat what he said.
Sorry. Any other members?
That's good.
Seeing no other questions on this, House File 1800, as amended, is laid over. We're still waiting for Representative Moeller, so we will move on the agenda to House File 2259. Representative Johnson, please come to the table with your testifiers. And while you're doing that, we will note the very nice thing of cupcakes. Representative Johnson is here.
And those are for everybody except Representative Steer.
What's that? I was looking for Representative Pete Johnson, if he noticed the cupcakes. What's that?
I don't know what he did wrong, but I'm just—that was my understanding.
He may or may not have had a bill yesterday and did not bring cupcakes. Representative Johnson, since you are not a member of this committee, I will move House File 2259 before the committee. Since your bill includes a general fund appropriation to the Department of Public Safety, we'll be laying the bill over for a possible inclusion on the omnibus committee bill. Representative Johnson, please explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, members. This bill proposes a one-time appropriation of $3.5 million in fiscal year 2026 to the Commissioner of Public Safety for Violent Crime Enforcement Teams, VCETs, you're going to hear that term many times, pursuant to Section 299A.642. VCET grants are available to state and local units of government to combat gang and drug crime. I have something to read here, and then I will pass it off to my testifiers that know much more than I do about this. So, as a county commissioner, I was on the city council, and also as a county commissioner, I got to spend a lot of time and get to know our local police chief and our sheriff. And during that time, I've been able to have a lot of conversations about what they're experiencing on the ground and out there in the field. And I just made a commitment when I was on the county commissioner to our sheriffs before I left. I said, I did this in my last year as chair, I never want to hear that our team on the ground and our law enforcement out there don't have the tools that they're necessary to do the job correctly. And if that includes what I can do is make sure that I can do what I can to make funding available that the tools. I'm a contractor and I know how important tools are to get the job done, but these tools make the difference between life and death and somebody going home to their family at night. So that's why I felt it's very important, and I was proud to be associated with this and bring this forward, is violent crime enforcement teams, or VCETs, are specialized multi-jurisdictional law enforcement units composed of peace officers from various local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies. VCETs investigate and combat violent crime, particularly in relation to gang activity, drug and gun trafficking, and other serious crime activities. There are currently 21 VCETs operating throughout Minnesota. These teams are funded by a combination of state and federal justice assistant grants. In 2010, the Minnesota legislature established a violent crime coordinating council to provide guidance related to the investigation and prosecution of gang and drug crime. The council provides direction and oversight to the VCETs. The Commissioner of Public Safety appoints a statewide VCET coordinator to coordinate activities, facilitate training, and monitor compliance with protocols. House File 20, House File 2259 increases VCET funding by $3.5 million in fiscal year 2026. The rationale for the amount is based upon the funding requests submitted by VCETs. You should have a document in your packet that lists the funding requests by each VCET and the amount awarded. I'd like to, at this time, Chair Novotny, to pass this off to the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Please have your testifiers say their full name and begin their testimony.
Rick Palaya, Hennepin County Sheriff's Office.
Mr. Palaya, go ahead.
All right. Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Novotny and Representative Johnson.
Can you speak get a little closer to the mic?
Yeah, sorry.
Here you go.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Novotny, Representative Johnson, and committee members. I'm Major Rick Palaya of the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, and I oversee the Investigations Bureau. I'm here today to speak to you about the importance of violent crime enforcement teams, or VCETs, commonly known as VSETs, and the critical need for additional funding to support their continued effectiveness. VSET funding is critical to support 21 Minnesota task forces' ongoing efforts to combat violent crime and continue to address the fentanyl crisis that is devastating our communities. As fentanyl deaths dramatically increased several years ago, drug task forces had to pivot their efforts and focus to fentanyl. And this work is having an impact. For the first time in the last decade, we have seen a significant decrease in overdose deaths over the past year. Over the past several years, task forces have continued efforts to combat the supply of drugs coming into our communities. This includes tremendous efforts placed on in-depth and long-term investigations into prominent drug cartels who are deep-rooted in Minnesota. Unfortunately, we do have the cartels in Minnesota very, very established. The results speak for themselves. VSETs have made significant increases in seizures of drugs, weapons, and other illegal contraband, such as pill presses used to manufacture fentanyl pills. Since 2022, statewide VSET fentanyl pill seizures have tripled. Powder fentanyl seizures have doubled. The total was well over 600,000 fentanyl pills and over 75 pounds of fentanyl powder in 2024 alone. 2 milligrams, just 2 milligrams, can kill someone with zero tolerance. That's the size of the tip of a pencil. Last year, Hennepin County Sheriff's Office Violent Offender Task Force and West Metro Drug Task Force alone seized over 300 illegal possessed firearms, over 260 pounds of methamphetamine, over 70,000 fentanyl pills, and over 17 pounds of fentanyl powder. Those are just two of the task forces operating in Hennepin County, and Ramsey County seized similar numbers. In terms of the value of seized contraband, VSETs provide an estimated 600% return on investment through seizure of illegal contraband. So funding these task forces is worth the money. Additionally, because human trafficking is so closely connected with illegal drug activity, these investigations sometimes identify human trafficking organizations and lead to the recovery of victims being trafficked. Despite these successes, we are facing a critical challenge. Costs associated with operating VSETs have increased dramatically, while VSET funds have remained stagnant. Without adequate funding to keep us up with the rising cost of technology and other essential resources such as training, personnel costs, evidence room management, insurance, and rent, our ability to continue making these gains will be severely compromised. For these reasons, Sheriff Witt asked that we work with all of our VSET partners and see if we can work on legislation to get more funding. I want to thank all of you on behalf of our task force and all the task forces across the state for considering this request. We hope this committee can find the necessary funds to make this happen this year. And I thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Next listed testifiers, Commander Hart. Commander Hart, say your full name and begin your testimony.
Rich Clark. I'm a commander with Ramsey County Sheriff's Office. So I did not prepare a statement because a lot of the things that we've already seen, you've heard about from Hennepin County, we're seeing not only in Ramsey County, but across the metro and across the state. The things that are happening here have a direct impact outstate Minnesota and in our region. So the groups we focus on, all the VSETs focus on similar groups. We focus on the most violent criminals, the repeat of criminals that are causing the most amount of chaos in our society, and large drug trafficking organizations. And yes, they do, they're outside of Minnesota and they're outside of our country. I've just recently taken over the VSET after being out of it for 10 years. I ran our violent crime enforcement team for 13 years, was out of it for 10 years. Commander Ryan O'Neill was the commander then. When I came back, I was surprised by a few things. Obviously, the increase in fentanyl that has caused harm to our society. We've seen things similar to that before, but nothing to this extent. When the meth crisis happened 15 years ago, we saw how it impacted our society. We took action to limit that impact, and I think we did a pretty good job of limiting that impact. The similar actions are being taken right now for heroin and fentanyl. So, and I expect the same successes with that. The one thing I was surprised at is when I left, our funding was at a certain level. It has not increased in 10 years. It actually decreased about 12 or 13 years ago while I was still a part of the task force. So as everything goes up, our costs, our personnel costs, our infrastructure costs, our technology costs, which we're using technology now that we haven't used in the past, just to level the playing field with the different cartels that are out there operating and causing harm to our society. While all those costs have increased dramatically, our funding has stayed flat or reduced. So that's why I was glad to see this bill come about. And it's needed funding, and the return on the funding is incredible. As you've heard, the return that we get for the dollars that are put in there causes real assistance to our law enforcement and our partners. And we've had to work smarter. We had to work more cooperatively with all the teams and other law enforcement and leverage other agencies as well, and we've done that. But this funding would definitely give us a leg up.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions for Representative Wayne Johnson or his testifiers? Representative Bedall.
I don't have a question. I just have a comment. Myself being a part of these VSETs, I was on one for 2 years before I came into the legislation, and they are crucial to our communities. The impact that they are able to do within our communities and the amount of crime that they actually investigate is ridiculous. If you guys have never been a part of one of these or have never actually got a chance to dig deep into what they do, I would recommend that you guys actually go out there and speak to the commanders, know exactly how much of an impact that these VSETs actually have in your community. They are big part of law enforcement, and this is a crucial amount of money that these guys need. So I hope everybody can support it as much as they can. Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe just a question I was reflecting as I was listening to this about the we've got the grants for human trafficking investigations, the other task forces as well. I think it's like $1 million per biennium, maybe. And maybe a question, then I'll have a comment, but just a question as to whether at this point the VSETs are working much. And I work with VSETs in my work as a prosecutor, so certainly Ramsey County, but others as well. But just wondering whether there's much of an intersection with the human trafficking investigation teams and task forces. I know with the BCA having the biggest one, but I think there's a couple others as well, as far as any of you are aware.
Yeah, so, my primary experience is in Hennepin County.
Right.
We do have someone assigned to the BCA human trafficking task force. And her investigations frequently merge into very, very violent criminals. So she has to lean on our VSET-funded task forces for help just to do her job safely. So they're merging those. guns and drugs and the human trafficking go hand in hand. Those investigations are often one and the same.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and so maybe just comment that it's always bothered me that it is so much less funding to those task forces. Not to say that there's not a big need in this area as well. Just sort of I'm reflecting, maybe thinking in conversation, Mr. Chair, as we're putting things together in the budget, because I know that we've got funds that we put in for investigating drug and gun trafficking, and we want to make sure investigating human trafficking as well. As the testifier said, there's certainly an overlap often in those situations, not always, but often as well. So I appreciate the chance just to think about how those different pieces are fitting together. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Johnson, response.
So I would like to, I don't know if that was just finish up here, Mr. Chair.
No, that was just if you had a response to Representative Pinto's comments.
I'm sorry. I was assuming you were talking. Can you repeat that question? Sorry.
Chair, really just more of a comment. I was just reflecting on how the amount of funds that we put in to investigate gun and drug trafficking versus the amount of funds that we put in to investigate human trafficking. At the moment, it's a sort of a 4-to-1 ratio. There's certainly a linkage between the two, as the testifier said, and it's always been something where I've thought, boy, I would want to make sure that there's, you know, somewhat more parity there, which isn't, we're obviously looking at this bill in isolation, it's going to be laid over, just something that I guess I'm reflecting on as part of the presentation about that point. So I'm not sure if you'd have any thoughts about that. Representative Johnson, not to put you on the spot, but I guess the chair was asking in case you did.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, Representative Pinto.
Johnson.
I would always be open to bringing more bills forward to bring those two numbers together. So if we can come up with more financing and funds available, we'd love to bring up the human trafficking that you said, that there's a differential so we can get more done, you know. A lot of things getting done are always limited by the finances. But if there's more available, I'd be more than happy and honored to be here again and presenting to looking for more funds.
Vice Chair Liddy.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you guys for the work you're doing. It's one of the most dangerous areas. My time at Burnsville, I handled a street crimes unit, and it was drugs, gangs, guns, and the human trafficking side of it. And what I learned is they kind of all overlap, and each one is local, and law enforcement needs to work together because there's various degrees, like you said, higher people that are more violent that might cross into your city. The teams work together. But also at a local level, you know where the hot spots are and what you need to work. So I just wanted to say thank you. I think Representative Pinto's comments are, you know, trying to overlap them is good because I do think in law enforcement, they work a lot together. So thank you again. Be safe.
Representative Johnson, closing comments.
Thank you, Representative Whitty, for those comments. That's one thing I was able to see when I was my time as a county commissioner and being involved with the sheriff's office is how often you go out to a scene and it's not just one, just not the city there, but it's many times it's the sheriff or the state or many different levels, and they do work together perfectly. So thank you. I just, Chair Devontae and members, I just want to make sure everybody received in their packet there too. We had some letters, the sheriff from Meeker, Sheriff Cruz from Meeker County, who was not able to make it at the last minute, so he provided a letter. We also have letters of support there from the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, and also Hennepin County, and then there's another one in there too. So I just want to make sure that that is out there. I think it's very important that we provide the tools that is necessary. You heard some stories. We would have had many more here today to testify, but due to timing, many members of the VSET team are actually in San Diego at the border learning more and preparing and training. So that's why they couldn't be here today. So they're constantly getting better in order to serve our community. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. With that, House File 2259 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Johnson and testifiers. Next bill on the agenda is House File 2017. That is my bill, and Vice Chair Whitty will be taking the gavel.
Chair Novotny, do you want to move House File 2017 before the committee?
I do.
It is my understanding we will be laying this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus. Is that correct?
That's correct.
There is an amendment to the bill coded DE1. If it's okay with the author of the amendment, we will have Chair Novotny present his bill and have the testifier speak before taking up the amendment. Chair Novotny, please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Witte. House File 2017 is a continuing grant that we've been doing since I've been here. The bill is bipartisan, has been carried by members of both parties, depending on the year. The funding is for the County Attorneys Association to put on ongoing updated training to deal with cases and things that change with different decisions that come down from the courts. And with me, I have, I'm honored to say, my county attorney, who is due to retire, so this is going to be your last time appearing. She's been a repeat witness in this committee on this bill, and I'm honored to have served with her, even when she was a public defender. But so, or served, you know, in capacities as a assistant county attorney when she was prosecuting, and vast experience. And with that, I turn my testimony over to County Attorney Haney.
Thank you and welcome, and good luck in your retirement. So we'll let you begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kathleen Haney. I'm the Sherburne County Attorney. I've had the honor to serve Sherburne County for the last 23 years as the county attorney and over 34 years now with the county itself. The Sherburne County Attorney's Office and the Minnesota County Attorney's Office has as its top legislative priority this funding bill. It's very critical for the training of all prosecutors and all county attorneys across the state of Minnesota. And first, I'd like to thank you for your past support, which has been so important to us in providing training funds. One of the requirements in the past for our training funds is being fulfilled in our 2025 trial school, which happens to be one of our most wanted courses and fills up quite quickly. And part of that curriculum will be a presentation from Victor Veith. He actually started as a prosecutor in the state of Minnesota. He will be training on racial disparities, collateral consequences, and trauma-informed responses. So we will be fulfilling the requirements of your last allocation to us. This year we are seeking $125,000 in training grants, and we recognize that these are public funds, and as public funds we wish to be cost conscious. We are always mindful of the fact that our training budgets at county attorney's offices are limited. The cost that we can get a credit through the County Attorneys Association is less than what we can find in the market. We also ask not only for your investment, but we invest in our own training. We seek the expertise of people like Representative Pinto, who's taught in the past for us, and we capitalize on that expertise through their training process. That allows us to stretch our budgets that we have and allow more opportunities for our attorneys. We also try to do different formats in terms of training. We have in-person training as well as online training. We have lunch hour trainings, which are very effective. It allows people outstate particularly to be able to capitalize on the education availability. And part of the struggle that county attorney's offices have is that we deal with public sector issues, and when you're looking at the marketplace, we don't always have the training that we need. So we have to develop that amongst ourselves, and we do draw on our own expertise. As you know, training is critical. I'm a child of two teachers, so education is imperative for me. But with the evolution of law and what I've seen over the last 30 years is that there's been an increase in the demands on prosecutors and on the civil attorneys in our office. The pace has changed appreciably, and the technology that we use now and what we handle as evidence is so drastically different. And the training provides us with the hands-on that we need. So I would ask for your support.
Thank you. Are there any member questions for Chair Novotny or its testifier? Seeing none, we will now take up the DE1 amendment. Who will be offering the amendment? Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will speak to the amendment, and then I'm going to withdraw it and hope that we can bring this back at some point. But this amendment is putting the same language into the bill as we passed it last year regarding making sure that the training funding that we're providing also contains instruction on racial disparities in the criminal justice system, collateral consequences to convictions, and trauma-informed responses to victims. And the reason why, well, first, Chair Novotny, thank you for bringing this bill, and thank you also to the county attorney for testifying today. I appreciate you being here. And as a prosecutor myself, I've taken many of these trainings, have also taught in a number of these courses, and it is really important because prosecutors, to your point about the marketplace, there really aren't a lot of other on-point trainings that prosecutors use, and we have to keep up with our license, but also learn what we need to learn to do the job. So it is important. But one of the things I have found over the years, and especially when I came to the legislature, is that a lot about collateral consequences and racial disparities and even trauma-informed victim practices isn't something that prosecutors are necessarily taught or even aware of. They have so many cases, they're working so quickly, and you know, I think taking a more of a comprehensive look at the system really helps people do their jobs better if they can understand different aspects of the system. I know when Vice Chair Feist presented her bill recently on restorative justice and victim survivors, I think the data was like 80 or 90% of victims found that process to be helpful, but 20% found that the justice system process wasn't helpful. I think that she's here. 94%. Okay, so 94 thought the restorative justice, and then like 24 felt like the traditional system wasn't very helpful. And I think that in large part could be people not practicing victim trauma-informed practices around victims. Not that it would solve that whole piece. So I do think that, especially for the County Attorneys Association, as they have their trial school training and also their annual conferences, that these aspects be incorporated. And I know they've done that in the past year, and it sounds like they'll continue. I really am more comfortable if we keep that language, if we're going to continue that funding. But like I said, I'm going to withdraw this now and hope that we can bring it back when the bill comes back. And they have talked to MCAA, and they are supportive of this language as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. At this time, Chair Mueller withdraws her amendment. With that, member discussion on the bill. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Novotny, or Chair Novotny, and County Attorney Haney, and I will say, as a former public defender, I thank you for your service, both as a public defender and a county attorney. And actually, my question is about that, because I really appreciate this, and I'm glad we're doing this. I think we need to make sure that trial school for all of our public attorneys, that folks get the training they need, and it is a unique experience, unlike when I was at a law firm and you have a bunch of CLEs, and it's a different experience. And so as someone went to trial school, but as a public defender, I'm wondering, and I don't know if this is a question for you or maybe a question for nonpartisan staff, and maybe in this budget or in the public or in the judiciary budget, but do we have a similar appropriation for public defenders trial school?
Chair Novotny.
Well, first of all, I knew as soon as I said it, I was wrong when I said it, and I fact checked myself. County Attorney Haney was a public, not a public defender. She was a private defense attorney for about 6 months. And like I said, as soon as I said that, I was wrong. So, as far as going to public defender, I believe they probably get the same training availability, but I'll leave that to.
I'm gonna go to John Waltz.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm not aware of any specific school for public defenders. I believe all of the training for the defenders comes from the Board of Public Defense itself, and so I don't know that there's any separate training put on, but it seems that Mr. Johnson might
I'm going to call a second friend and go to Ben Johnson.
Mr. Small is here. Would he know?
Mr. Chair, members, the judiciary budget has not historically typically called out a line item for specific public defender training in it. However, there is money in the base budget that at least on occasions has been used for public defender trial school and related trainings.
Mr. Smalley.
Thank you, Chair. And to your question, when we did this a number of sessions ago, we did it in coordination with the public defender. I don't know that they renewed it or not, but I know that we did it jointly, I want to say two sessions ago. So it's not like we were trying to screw them. We were trying to work with them.
Can you state your name?
I'm so sorry, Mr. Chair. Robert Small, I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I apologize.
Thank you. We called you up on the fly. So, Representative Greenman.
Thank you. And that was not my point at all. I want to make sure, I think that this is a great program. I think we should be providing this service. And as somebody who was a public defender, I know that the relationship that public defenders and county attorneys and city attorneys have is really, really important. And so making sure that both get the training, and I will check in on the judiciary budget, but I just want to make sure that we're providing this for both sides of our justice system as we think about the lawyers that are serving the people of Minnesota. Thank you.
Chair Mueller, you have anything else? Chair Novotny, closing comments.
This is a good bill. I appreciate the testifiers for coming down and showing up and answering the questions, and we'll continue to move this forward. It's good training that everyone needs, from the county attorneys and the assistant county attorneys, and then the trickle down that gets down to law enforcement. So when the cases change, it's very fluid. It's important to have that and get the information so that everyone is on the same page statewide. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, House File 2017 is laid over. Thank you, Chair Novotny, to you and your testifiers.
Last bill on the agenda is House File 1821. Vice Chair Woody, please come to the table with your testifiers. Vice Chair Woody, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yes, that's my...
Since your bill includes general fund appropriations, the Department of Public Safety, we will be laying the bill over for possible inclusion in a committee omnibus. Vice Chair Woody, please explain your bill.
Thank you. House File 1821 is a nonprofit supplement security grants. Minnesota Supplement Nonprofit Security Grant Program began in 2017 after a series of high-profile bomb threats against Jewish community centers nationally and here in Minnesota. There should be a WCCO news story on a bomb threat at a community center in St. Paul in your packet for you to review. Since that time, several states have dedicated funding to assist vulnerable nonprofits to make them more secure. The federal nonprofit security grant program is very competitive, and less than 2% of all federal money goes to Minnesota applicants. The legislators have provided supplement grant funds for Minnesota nonprofits, which are administered by the Department of Public Safety Office of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. There should also be a one-pager in your packet on how the program works. The grants are geared towards religious institutions and other nonprofits that have a heightened risk of being the victim of domestic or foreign terrorism. The program has always had bipartisan support, and it does today. Vice Chair Feist is a co-author of my bill, as is Representative Kraft and Chair Novotny. And now I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers.
First testifier we have listed is Rob Allen. Mr. Allen, begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Rob Allen, and I'm the Director of Community Security for the Jewish Community Relations Council of Minnesota and Dakotas. In that role, I help synagogues, schools, day camps, and nonprofit organizations throughout the three states be as safe as possible for people who want to practice their faith, learn, be together, and serve their community. Unfortunately, a big part of my job is addressing the steady stream of hateful anti-Semitic vitriol experienced by members of the community I serve. In just the last year, the windows of an organization that serves students were shot out, causing not only fear but thousands of dollars in damage to the organization's building. A historic synagogue experienced thousands of dollars of damage as swastikas were spray painted on it. A cemetery experienced anti-Semitic damage that resulted in repair costs in the thousands of dollars. On a weekly basis, I get reports from organizations that I serve getting hateful and threatening voicemail and email messages. There's a little bit of good news in all this, however, and that's this. The windows that were shot out did not completely shatter because we had invested in ballistic film that held the windows intact. When the synagogue was vandalized, we were able to identify the suspect because of investment in video cameras. The fact that we are able to investigate these threats, work with law enforcement, and provide more than 100 hours per week of armed security patrolling our organizations in the metro areas because our community generously supports community security. It's also important to note that we work very closely with many colleagues in other faith communities. The sad reality is that people who target Jewish facilities are equally likely to target mosques, churches, or other organizations with which they have a dispute. Faith groups have this in common. We are open and we're welcoming, which makes security particularly challenging. And we put the burden of vigilance on volunteers who, frankly, would rather be practicing their faith than posted up maintaining security. The nonprofit security grant program was developed to help small nonprofits with target hardening that they couldn't otherwise afford. My organization doesn't seek nonprofit security grant funds because we don't want to compete against smaller organizations that have security needs for which security funding will have a much greater impact. These funds help provide facilities, resources that allow their members to focus on worship, on fellowship, on service, on learning, without the distraction of being the sole physical security presence. I also want to point out that security investments don't just make the grantee safer, they make the community safer. More than half of the cases where I'm asked to gather electronic evidence, video, license plate records, and so forth, are cases in which law enforcement asked us to provide information on crimes not related to the organizations that had the technology there. For example, an organization's video system may capture the license plate of a crime elsewhere in the community, and that's more than half of the cases that we deal with. I urge the committee to consider supplementing the small amount of funding that Minnesota nonprofit organizations get from the federal government so that we can continue to keep nonprofit organizations and the community as a whole safe. Thank you.
Thank you. Tamar Pudis, state your name and begin your testimony.
Mr. Purtis couldn't be here today. Mr. Purtis could not be here. I was just informed.
All right. Pallavi Singhal. State your name correctly and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Pallavi Singhal, and I am the program manager for risk management at the third largest Hindu temple located right here in Maple Grove, Minnesota. Now, places of worship are more than just an area to go and pray. Devotees go there to go and build a sense of community. They go there to build new connections, foster a sense of networking, and even learn more about culture. Now, all of this cannot be done if their sense of security is compromised. In the past year, houses of worship around Minnesota have been attacked around 14 times. That's 14 times too many. We cannot foster a safe community if our own safe spaces are currently and constantly under targeted violence attacks. These places of worship are normally built on lands that are more farther out and separated from centralized business districts. This sometimes makes them sitting ducks, and this kind of creates a higher risk for targeted violence. As some of the training events that I have attended that have been hosted by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, MN Fusion Center, and FBI, they have clearly laid out the steps of targeted violence and laid out and helped me connect with other houses of worship. And they stated that these attacks were pre-planned, they were targeted, and there has been much loss in the community due to this. And this creates a sense of tension in the community, and we need help to create more of a fund so that we can basically create more of a fiscal program and allocate more funds dedicated solely to security. This doesn't only mean upgrading our security cameras, upgrading our locks and our doors. This means also having better training programs for our volunteers, because most of our houses of worship are volunteer run. We don't pay our members to do this. They are there solely on their own benefit. It's a social cause. We also want to make sure that this is a place where people can feel safe once again, not under constant threat. And I personally am a target and have been a victim of this violence. My place of worship was attacked twice in the last year, once in March and once in June, resulting in over $70,000 of damaged goods, lost items, and vandalism. This itself created such a tense environment, and I also got to see this on both sides of the coin, because I work on the committee that works to secure our premises and train our own volunteers. And this is why I'm here asking you all to help us allocate better budgets, not only for my organization, but for all of the houses of worship, the churches, the synagogues, the temples, the Buddhist temples, and all of this. So please come together and help us, you know, feel safe once again. Thank you.
Thank you. Last listed testifier, Jelani Hussein.
I think I might be gonna switch seats if that's okay.
Mr. Hussein, state your full name, begin your testimony.
Chair Novotny, members, my name is Jelani Hussein. I'm the executive director for the Council of American Islamic Relations Care in Minnesota. Thank you for letting me chance to testify today. As you can see, we have all members of our different faiths here today speaking about the urgency and the need for this supplementary support for this grant. My organization is sometimes the first organizations that people call from our community to identify an incident that happens and to find out what they should do. I remember I was not even in the United States at the time. I was in visiting family back home in Somalia, and when Dar Farouk had a bomb, three individuals drove all the way from Illinois with the intention to kill, and they bombed the mosque in Bloomington. They called me, and we began to immediately look at what happened. That incident shocked us here in Minnesota. But we have seen now a troubling trend that I want to share with you. Unfortunately, the state of Minnesota currently leads the nation in attacks against mosques for the last 4 years. We now have documented over 44 separate incidents. Those incidents include damages that we believe to be totaling over $3 million. We've had, in 2024, 15 separate incidents. And our national office would also keeps a record of national attacks against mosques in the United States, recording 40 incidents, 15 of them being here in Minnesota. The next state to us was California with 5 separate incidents. In 2023, we had a very difficult time. We had an incident where a man came to burn down one of our mosques, Masjid Umar. The next day, we met at a nearby mosque to discuss the incident and to talk about what was going on, talk about community safety, only to have the door knocked in our meeting to be told that the mosque is on fire. We said, no, there was a mosque that was on fire yesterday. That's what we're talking about. They said, no, this mosque is on fire. And we began to walk outside, and we saw literally the second floor of the mosque completely engulfed. At that time, screaming and yelling to find out what is going on, how many people are here. Thankfully, we had a hero, a young man who saw the fire and had the great wits of not only calling 911, but actually literally walking across the street where the fire department was. And while he was on 911, actually door knocking at the fire department. And that really saved our center. What was interesting also is that that center had a full-time daycare at the time. We had to pull out 50 children, including babies, out from a door where the flames were going on. We became not only just to help there, but became victims. Last year, one of my staff members was on his way to support one of the mosques, Masjid Hikmah, which the imam is here today, Abdurrazak Kainan. He was there to help that mosque apply for this grant. And on his way to the mosque, a man who has been targeting this mosque, which there have been several incidents where he has assaulted and targeted individuals of the mosque, came and used his vehicle to hit my staff member, who thankfully survived. It was ironic to see that he was there to help them apply for this grant while he was assaulted with that vehicle attack. These incidents are not isolated. They're not only happening to the Muslim community. We've seen also in other nonprofits attacked. In February of last year as well, the American Experiment also faced an arson that took down their office. This security grant provides basic security needs, cameras, lights, and doors, which are basic principles to help prevent and also secure the community. As you heard earlier, these cameras are also used to prevent other attacks, as well as also to ensure that the community at large is safe. This funding, as we know, in the state of Minnesota, gets a very small slice of the federal budget. That is why it is urgently needed to have the supplementary support. And that is why today we're asking, as this is a bipartisan bill, that as a challenging year we have this year with the deficit and the challenges, that this particular need is taken with significant need for it and prioritized. And I'll end with this by saying that this particular grant, I have seen immediately those in mosques or those in centers that have benefited from it, we have seen a decrease of the things that were happening, simple things that are not even considered to be major incidents. And the final piece I'll say is that we have about 90-plus mosques in the state of Minnesota. They serve predominantly the poorest Minnesotans, according to state demographers. The Somali or Eastern African community are the poorest in the state, with 75% being poor, and 56% of them being even deeply poor. So what we are noticing is that our safety protocols in our Islamic centers are also very limiting, using cameras and security systems that are oftentimes not adequate, and we have seen them countlessly fail. In the attack that I mentioned that I was at, the cameras, the mosque did have some cameras, but those cameras were not properly installed, they were not properly equipped, they were not even able to show what actually happened at that incident. So with that, I want to thank all of you for making this a bipartisan effort, as it always has traditionally been, and I look forward to seeing this being supported.
Thank you, Mr. Hussein. Looks like one more person is up there. We don't have you on the list, so if you could state your full name and make sure you sign in on the clipboard so we have that for the minutes to add in, and begin your testimony.
So my name is Makram El-Amin, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, Makram El-Amin, the Imam of Masjid An-Nur in North Minneapolis. I also over here to encourage the committee to provide additional support for this grant, to supplement the grant. Our mosque specifically was targeted in the last couple of years. In fact, one of our senior members, two of them actually were injured, severely injured. One was shot multiple times outside of our mosque. Another was hit by a hit and run situation. And in both incidents, we think they could have been provided if we would have more adequate support to ensure the safety of the worshipers, those who are coming, and as many say, many are volunteers that are coming in and out just to learn, to fellowship, to serve, to and to worship, essentially. And in addition to that, because we are in these urban centers and we provide a lot of service, not only is it from the threats from the external, but also even from those who are coming in that are in need of service at many times. So we also in need of those who are suffering from mental health issues. Some have opioid addictions and others that we are trying to serve in the community, but also pose a threat to us if we don't have adequate coverage and security mindedness as well. Along with the phone calls, the attacks, I have personally received numerous dozens of threatening phone calls from members of community just randomly, just threatening for some reason or another. They have some disgruntledness. Many of them don't even have an affiliation to what we're doing directly, but nonetheless, we are still subject to these sorts of threats. So, again, my encouragement to the committee, Mr. Chair and the committee, that to really supplement this grant for the safety of all of our houses of worship and nonprofits who are delivering service in this community. So I just thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions for Representative or Vice Chair Witte or his testifiers? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to express my support for this funding for all of the reasons that our testifiers shared with their personal experiences. This funding is clearly very necessary, and it is my sincere hope that we get to a point as a society when we can spend all this money on something fun, big party. It's just so unfortunate that this is where we're at as a society, but I'm really proud of the state of Minnesota for stepping up and playing a part. So thank you for bringing this bill. I'm happy to be a co-author.
Thank you. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this bill. I've had a chance to talk to many of you about it. Thank you, Representative Witte, for bringing this bill. Quick question, because I, for the last couple of years, and I think it was a year and a half ago, the Minneapolis delegation met with Homeland Security, with the city, to just try to get an assessment of the need, as we saw both the rise of the mosque arsons and bombings, the rise of targeting on the Jewish community, and trying to get an assessment of the need. And it was very clear that the federal program was hard to navigate and hard for folks to connect into, as well as not meeting all of the needs. And so I really see a need for the state to step in. I'm wondering, and this is probably not a fair question because probably the answer is more money than we have in our budget, but I'm wondering if you could give a sense of what the actual need is out there that we're trying to serve in terms of maybe not dollars, but in terms of the mosques and synagogues and temples that we need to make sure that get some access to the $75,000 grant.
Anyone? Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, members, I will say that the average grant that has been awarded to institutions varies between about $50,000 and $75,000, and almost always the organization expends double what they were granted. So they have to find that money from congregants and from other sources as well. It's also the organization has to pay that money up front and then hope to receive the money and grants later on. So it's very challenging for the organizations, and they don't undertake asking for these grant funds lightly because it is such a burden, A, to go through the process, B, to upfront the money that they may get reimbursed, and it's a very challenging process to get reimbursed for those funds as well.
Program manager Singhal, it sounds like you looked like you wanted to say something on this too.
Yes. I agree wholeheartedly with the organizations do expend about double the amount, about 100,000 to about 150,000 we're looking at. And this happens with a split between, we're looking at about foundational security equipment. So we're looking at security cameras, upgrading locks, scanning equipment for the volunteers to access the buildings, automatic locking systems. This is like the first step. And what actually happens is that there has been a drastic movement in the community where we are having the local government and local law enforcement come in and do security assessments. They usually come and do that for free. for these areas, and they actually tell you where the best placement for cameras, where the best placement for locks should be. Then you usually outsource to a contractor to get these placed in, or you, if you're lucky enough, you have a community member who can actually implement these in. And then the second set of the money usually goes toward training these volunteers, because if the volunteers aren't trained on how to implement the protocol, then having these high-tech security systems is quite useless, to be honest. So majority of the money would go in training.
You asked me something. Mr. Hussein?
I guess one thing I wanted to add is that the federal grant is up to $150,000 per institution, but what we have noticed is because of the demand for this, any institution that needs a second grant has not gotten a second grant. So right now, what we're seeing is only organizations getting for the first time. And most of the funding can also be used as well for security guard, because many of our houses of worship have constant events throughout the year. So because of the demand for this grant, it's often just become a one-time grant. And we feel bad because there is a huge need for it. So I think for the state portion of it could really be a much needed support right now that is not there at all.
Representative Green.
Thank you, and thank you for bringing that and sharing that experience. And I think when I go to synagogue, I definitely feel safer that there's a security person there. Excuse me. And I think that it is really it's a tough time that we have to harden our places of worship or our places where kids go to summer camp and whatever else in their religious faith, but. Given where we're at, I think that these kinds of resources and investments and thinking about it in a multi-faith way is really important. And so thank you for the work you all do. I think that the folks there who serve as security, usually they're volunteers in their places of worship, are doing God's work, for lack of a better term. And so thanks again, and thank you for bringing this bill.
Any other questions for Representative Whitty or his testifiers? Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for bringing this bill. And thank you also to all the testifiers. The situations you described are truly horrific, and I'm sorry that you and your houses of worship have experienced those things. I do have a question about the federal dollars. So this handout is really, really quite helpful. And it sounds like Minnesota doesn't get a lot of federal funding for what's out there, but it's $8 million. And I see that it's through FEMA, and I do know that the Trump and Musk administrations are really freezing federal funds, and there's potential cuts coming. I know I'm getting looks about this. It is the reality of what's happening right now, and I'm just curious if there's any funding freezes, like with the $8 million that we're getting, where are you at in the application process? Are websites still working, et cetera? Just wondering what the status is of that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Allen.
We don't know. Our national organization, my colleagues nationally, don't know what the current status is. The state has not put out the FOMO, I forget what FOMO stands for, but they haven't put out the applications yet, so we don't know what the status is.
Chair Moeller. Mr. Hussein.
We are every year actively campaigning for this, all of our organizations. And I know last year we did receive additional support in this grant. So we're, I guess, cautiously optimistic that the federal partners will stay on course on this issue, particularly with the rise of anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in this country. I think hopefully this will be a priority even with the Trump administration.
Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one more question. When is the request for proposal usually up, just so we have an idea? So as we're putting together our budget, if we're aware of if that's up or not up, is there a certain timeline that's usually followed?
May
is what I'm hearing.
Vice Chair Whitty.
It's been March the last couple of years, but
Mr. Allen.
Yeah. I'm sorry,
go ahead.
Mr. Chair. March to May. The notice of funding opportunity goes out usually in March.
with an application deadline by May 1st, typically.
Thank you. Chair Mueller.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I thank you for that. I don't know why I'm getting looks. It's the reality of the situation that we're living in right now, and want to make sure that you're getting the federal dollars that are so important, and frankly, Minnesota should be getting more, and also what we can do at the state level to help. So I just, again, want to say thank you.
Thank you. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just note to that point, $10.4 million of FEMA money that was administered to Hennepin County last year alone on a recent FOIA was shown to be used for housing and room and board and services for folks who aren't Minnesotans, who aren't Americans. It would definitely benefit if we were to use those dollars for initiatives like this, the rise in anti-Semitism, the rise in hate crimes directed towards certain religious groups is staggering and it's disgusting. And I just wish that we would refocus when we talk about those federal funds. We should focus back on what we're actually here listening to, this great bill that's brought by Representative Woody. So thank you.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, unfortunately, what's happening at the federal level is a chainsaw being taken to federal funds and not a scalpel to, you know, carefully consider what should be cut and what's not. So that's the situation that we're in right now. And again, I wasn't asking this to be cute or funny or anything like that. I think it's a serious question. Mm-hmm. When federal funds are helping fund important services in our state, we do need to ask the question and be mindful of that as we're putting together the budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. When I'm putting together the budget, I'm reminded that yesterday we had to have the discussion over how we're going to fund domestic abuse centers. And I specifically didn't mention which administration had more than half cut the funding to domestic abuse stat. I would hope that in the future that we keep the discussions in this committee on things that are related to this committee and things that we can affect and that we can respond to. Chair Whitty, do you have a close, or Vice Chair Whitty, do you have a closing statement?
Yes, I just want to say I appreciate any support, what we can do here in the state of Minnesota. The intent of this money is that it's a supplemental. These organizations have demonstrated that they take this very serious and to keep their places of worship safe. And they're not completely relying on just the state for nonprofit security. So I just appreciate everyone's support and what we can do for our part in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, House File 1821 is laid over. Thank you, Vice Chair Whitty, and your testifiers. Before we will leave today, I'm glad Representative Curran was able to make it back. Nonetheless, made statements yesterday that could easily be seen as being hurtful. I made a statement yesterday when we were talking about there's lawyers on one side and cops on the other side. Well, to be honest, there's former cops on both sides. And I respect that. I respect your service, and I respect that you did, and I did not mean that at all. So I saw the look of hurt, and I couldn't understand why until it was explained to me afterwards. I did not mean that.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. With that, our next committee meeting will be Tuesday, March 25th at 3 p.m. There is no further business before the committee today. This meeting is adjourned.